Hello, I'm Dan Safarik, and this is Unfrozen.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and our guest today is Peter Devereaux, founding principal and former CEO of HED. But that is not the capacity in which Peter is joining us today. Because about 6 months ago, I was approached by a then shadowy group called the Innovation Design Consortium, the IDC, that was, as best I could tell, a pooling of some of the largest firms in the industry. Acronyms you've definitely heard of, SOM, NBBG, HKS, HOK, and I could just keep going on with the acronyms. But they were pooling their efforts together to better understand technology. And now with Peter as the board chair of the IDC, they have finally come out of stealth. Architects coming out of stealth, what a world we live in, to talk a bit about how they are, again, pooling their efforts here to understand AI and the future of technology when it comes to architecture, engineering, construction. So, Peter, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you. It's a topic I enjoy talking about.
Well, now that the IDC is like finally made its debut, has a website and everything, and is out there beating the bushes for members, what is the IDC? What was the impetus behind it? Is this your brainchild? Or who really led this idea to not have every individual firm recreate the wheel when it comes to architecture tech and decide to band together?
Well, let me take you back a little bit and give you some history on it. And we have to mention, I think, the AIA Large Firm Roundtable. So this is a group that started in, I think it was about 1982, of the large firms. And it was mainly because at the time it was Harold Adams, CEO of RTKL at the time, who started the group and was looking for something that the AIA wasn't giving them at the time, which was more of a special interest group for large firms that had issues different than, you know, most of the firms in the country are quite small. And so the structure of the large firm roundtable is that there's multiple groups. There's a group for CEOs that meets in person twice a year. And there are also groups for HR leaders and the technology leaders and the corporate attorneys and so forth. And they all meet twice a year. And I began representing our firm with that group in 2006. and then I got elected onto the executive committee of that group. And when you're on this six-person executive committee, each one of the committee members must be a liaison to one of the other groups to sort of report back to the CEOs what's going on in HR, what's so on. And I was the representative to the technology group. And it wasn't long after I started going to that group, and by the way, some of the smartest people I ever met are the chief technology leaders for these large firms. I started to realize that our firms were all doing pretty much the same thing at the same time, and that we'd all be spending, say, $50,000 to make some little patch to make a particular piece of software work better or talk to another piece of software, and we all pretty much use the same software. So I went back to the executive committee of the CEO group and I said, you know, this is kind of crazy. Why don't we just throw some more money in the kitty for the LFRT and instead of each one of us spending $50,000 to write this code, why don't we do it one time and just let everybody have it? It's not the secret sauce. And the CEOs all said, yes, let's do that. And so I went back to the technology group and gave them that message. And I have to tell you, it took a little while because people were still afraid of that level of collaboration. But we finally got to the point where those conversations were moving along strongly. And let me give you another bit of LFRT history. Carol Wedge was the chair of the whole group. She was the CEO at Shepley Bullfinch. And I'll credit her with, when I first joined the organization, it was basically a bunch of white men like myself who sat around and griped. It was a big gripe session about what was wrong with our industry. It was kind of cathartic, and everybody went home and said, we have the same problems as everybody else. I don't feel so bad anymore. It's under Carol's six-year leadership that I think the idea came about that, well, maybe we could do something about these issues. And another CEO that I'll give some credit to was Bob Packard from Zimmer Gunzel Friska. Bob was the one who had a meeting, I think, after Carol had become chair, asked the group of CEOs, what's out there that's going to do to us what Uber did to the taxi drivers? And that sent everybody out into orbit. I mean, that got everybody very concerned because you could see that there was an issue there. So Carol organized one of our two-day meetings in person in Virginia Beach in 2019, where we had as our goal and objective to actually figure out how we as a group could affect some positive change on the whole industry. All of the minutes and recordings of that meeting are really central to what the IDC is doing. And unfortunately, we hit COVID not long after that. And everything kind of went into slow motion as that process started, but it was actually very positive in the way that I was finishing up my six-year term on the executive comm. Brad Lukanik from Canon Design, who's a much younger CEO than I was sort of stepping onto that. And I'll credit Brad Lukanik with the idea of saying to really do what we could do with the IDC, let's not have it limited just to the 50 firms in the large firm roundtable. Let's create this new entity, the Innovation Design Consortium. Let's make it a public benefit corporation, and let's open it up to all the firms in the country, which is what we did.
Which raises the next question, which is, what does the IDC do? Are you then writing software? Do you as a group lobby against, I'll just say, Autodesk, for example, and sort of the vendors that are out there? Or do you write RFPs collaboratively? Or, yeah, it's fascinating to have the large firms banding together their tech efforts, but in practice, what does that amount to? And how can architects exert more power over their tools or write their own tools?
Boy, I apologize if I can't give short answers to things, but we started out, so originally, remember what I was saying, we started out with this idea that we could do these small little projects, these $50,000 widgets, things that patch two pieces of software or make something work more efficiently. It was never our goal to become a software company, and it still isn't. But one of the things that happened after we started the IDC, formed it, funded it, and started meeting monthly with our steering committee and identifying projects. The first project, as you all well know, because it's how we connected with you for the first time, was a quick project, was coming up with this guidelines for the use of generative AI. And I think part of that connection, also, we started thinking that we could do something bigger than these little widgets that we started working on, that we all started coming to a better understanding of what AI is, how it might impact us, like Uber impacted the taxi drivers, and that we also realized that AI works when it has a sort of curated database of good data, let's put it that way. And we realized that our industry does not have good data, our firms do not have good data, and that none of our firms are large enough to have a data set that is really impactful. And so the light bulb sort of went off, and you know, an old friend of mine from Yale is Phil Bernstein, who wrote a book about machine learning and artificial intelligence, and I was having conversations with him. And I said to him one day, you know, maybe this IDC is the group that could be the first group that curates an actual database for the industry. And then various software companies could bubble up that develop AI applications working off of this database that we put together. So we're still making little patches and widgets and things like that, but now we have a more long-term goal about how we could really impact the industry.
Well, interesting. So the project you mentioned, I was proud to work on this with Cornell Tech. And for listeners, there's both a proprietary version of that report for the IDC, and there's a public version, which we'll put in the show notes there, which contains interviews with Phil Bernstein at Yale. And I would say the interesting bookend to this, having it started with the AIA large firm roundtable, is that back in May, Phil Bernstein and I and Chris Minerva from Thornton Tomasetti and a gentleman from Autodesk, whose name I don't remember, went and presented to the Canadian large firm roundtable. So we're trying to bring North America together on this. But the question I would ask is, then, Peter, is in terms of those, between those patches, how do you expect generative AI to transform the field, or where do you think that's going, or what's the hunch in there? Because I've enjoyed listening in the calls of the steering committee on the AI front. And there's lots of discussion there. I know, for example, Greg Schlissner at HOK is trying to write his own specification so that architecture firms could have better data on this. What's the technological agenda of the IDC? Like, if you had to lay out a roadmap of, like, well, here's the biggest issues that are pressing us, what are those, and how do you intend to tackle them in terms of finding other partners or vendors, or, you know, where does your influence extend to?
So I'll tell you what we're currently doing is we've contracted with Volker Boucher. And for those who may not know who that is, Volker was the former IT leader for Arup. And so he had a huge IT staff working. I mean, Arup is an enormous global company. And part of what his previous experience was working with industries on large data sets. And his specialty in consulting now is helping huge corporations with data initiatives. And what his interest in all this is looking at the IDC as something that takes, so right now we have 40 member firms of the IDC. We haven't figured out yet how to open it up through some kind of subscription process. We're working on that. But even the 40 firms that are the first ones to get involved, we have about 20,000 employees. We do about $7 billion in fee, and I forgot, it's an enormous amount of construction that all of that amounts to. So even that initial group of 40, there's a big data set right there. So we're sort of at what Volker is calling phase zero right now, which is getting us and our firms to think about data in a new way, develop some data literacy within our firms. In order to have a good data initiative, it's not something that's confined just to the technology group. This is something that everybody has to embrace, because we're talking about sort of, you know, what are the transformative things that could happen? And this goes back to, you know, my connection with Phil Bernstein. What Phil still teaches today at Yale is a class where he challenges the Yale architecture students to think of a new business model, right? They haven't come up with anything yet, at least that he's shared with me, that really is transformative. But I think that's what all of us CEOs are trying to figure out. I think we all realize that we have to get out of the business of selling our time by the hour for the production of two-dimensional construction documents. I think we all believe that that's going to get automated in the near future. That's something that's one of the, I'll call it more on the widget side projects, that although it's the biggest one that the IDC is working on, is how do we really go from design development to CDs in a very automated way using Revit software, all right? To do that would require a lot of the standardization of terms and processes and things that we think the IDC could help the whole industry with. So, you know, I think that is the thing that, you know, some entity, you know, it could be, as I've talked about, it could be one of these platform roll-ups that, you know, there are so many of them now in the industry. These are big private equity companies that are coming in and buying up firms and putting them into a platform. And I think the idea is that if you have big money behind you, you could put one of those, you could add technology to one of those platforms and make it transformational to the industry. And so I think we all, you know, none of our firms are sitting on a several hundred million dollars in cash. So we felt that banding together might be a way of self-preservation for the idea that there could be still smaller creative firms that can exist within the industry.
Speaking of preservation, I had an idea about, as you were talking about the trying to put a roadmap down for generative AI, you know, I guess my question would be around where is the line drawn around what's proprietary knowledge and or what is proprietary software architecture derived from that knowledge from within a firm and what is considered to be shareable. The reason that I ask this is because there are already firms that have literally cloned or gathered the accumulated knowledge of the embedded knowledge of senior people and created AI models from them that would answer the questions that you would ask that person if they were in the room with you. Thornton Tomasini's done this, and it was prescient that they did because the individual that they cloned actually recently died. So it was extremely, it showed extreme forethought that they were able to do this. But I'm just wondering, in the IDC context, you know, what's considered shareable, what's considered proprietary when it comes to AI models of expertise?
Yeah. No, I'm familiar with what you're talking about with Thornton Tomasini. That's basically a large language model, as I understand it, where you can sort of ask questions to the elder and still get some answers, which is a cool thing. I think what we're talking about that's more transformational is, you know, how do you have a database that actually impacts or is useful to a creative designer and maybe works in an automated system to produce designs?
Yeah, it's the tacit knowledge of a firm. I think Phil described it in one of the interviews I did with him in the sense of, you know, every hospital room that NBBJ has ever done, can you actually take that data set and create a ground zero NBBJ accumulated knowledge hospital operating room to then start from, for example, or these other things?
Yeah, I think all of our firms have realized that our data just is no good. And it's because we're so fragmented. Our firm has been working on standardization in a very fervent way now for probably about 3 years. All right. That's not a whole lot of time. And there's intense resistance to it, right, from the grassroots. I wouldn't say any longer because people are starting to understand why this imperative is there. But the way our whole industry works is people gained their own knowledge. They had their own ways of working. They've taught their small group of people who sat in an office with them a particular way of doing things, and each way was different. And I know that, you know, when this goes back many years, we got the idea that we'd hire a data scientist who would mine our data for us, and we hired a brilliant young man named Kishore Patel who I had to let him go after 6 months because, you know, all he did was prove how brilliant he was and how bad our data was because, you know, he could give us reports on just about anything, but they were kind of meaningless because it was garbage in, garbage out.
Well, it's also the question of, you know, firm expertise. So that, I mean, it gets to the point there, Peter. So yeah, you have this data, like number one, how is the consortium deciding like what is shared and what is not shared, which I've sat in some interesting conversations too, where they're trying to figure out what's our secret sauce versus our collective secret-ish sauce. But then, yeah, more broadly in the sense of like, yeah, can you capture like that latent IP? Because that sort of thing, like this tacit knowledge of firms that could be captured in the tools, I think is the most interesting aspect of generative AI. And we see, of course, with the image generators, the Midjourneys and others, you know, could you create the Zaha Hadid filter, for example, like one of the obvious starting places? And that seems like pretty facile, but there does seem potential value in this about what can you capture of like how firms do things to apply that to future designs.
This whole idea of data sharing, right, which is also what Volcker is working with us on right now. That's actually how we got to Volcker Boucher, was our data sharing group reached out to him. And, you know, what we're learning is, well, first of all, we're doing something that's never been done before. So we honestly are sort of making it up as we go along. And as we go along, we keep seeing that there are bigger horizons out there for us than we initially started with. So we did hire Fish and Richardson because we, to your point about sharing data, Fish and Richardson is one of the largest intellectual property global attorney groups out there. And we got one of their attorneys who specialize in intellectual property to help us through this issue, because it's a very good question about once you start sharing data, whose intellectual property is it? Who has responsibility for the reuse of that data? And frankly, we, you know, before we could share any data, we bogged down into this big process of drafting up agreements that the 40 firms had to sign with the IDC to protect the firms, to protect the IDC, to define, you know, the quality of what's coming in, the quality of what's going out. And we're at the point now where we've got like 30 of the 40 firms having signed those agreements, which when you think about it in itself, each firm has its own corporate counsel, its own internal group of lawyers, or in our case, we're only a 400 person firm, one attorney. But can you imagine getting 40 attorneys to agree on a document? That was a major achievement in and of itself. And it will be part of when we open this up to other firms, if you want to get into the what we call the digital content library, you'll need to, you know, as part of it, you'll accept the terms and conditions, which will essentially be this document. The other thing that we have to work on next, when we talk about sharing content, was we need some sort of give to get agreement, right? It's not just pay your money. It's you need, if you want to take content out of the library, you have to agree to put content into the library, because the impact of what we're doing is really only meaningful if that database begins to fill up with a wide berth of data from all across the country, from firms large and small.
Well, that's what I was, just a quick clarification then. So, I mean, is this open source content? I mean, the code that's being built at these patches, and are you applying it to existing commercial software, or are you going to get actually into tool creation using some of these practices out there for building open source tools? You can imagine the IDC, you know, buy your way in, and then suddenly you can fork code and build your own tools. I can imagine it's potentially fruitful.
Boy, now remember, you're talking to an architect, not a technology person. But what I'll tell you is, it, you know, so our shared content library, because our shared content library has lots of digital content. Some of it is code that's hosted on GitHub. As I understand it, though, you only get access to that when you're a member of the IDC. So it's open to whoever is a member. And I think the answer is a bit of yes to both, that we will be writing some things that will be proprietary to the IDC. You know, after all, what we're trying to do is we're trying to keep this thing going into perpetuity. So we have to figure out how do we get some kind of reasonable income stream that allows us to keep going. And to your earlier question, I think we are utilizing, we're paying, reimbursing our firms for work that they put into creating some of these things. And we're writing RFPs and going out into the industry, well, worldwide, basically, which has been the pleasant surprise, is that it's, we're finding out that we can do a lot of these things for a lot less money than we originally budgeted. Because when we put out a global RFP, we get responses from all around the world that will do things at a great value, let's put it that way, and do them well. And so that's been a pleasant surprise that we're not spending money as quickly as we thought we might have to.
When you're putting out RFPs, is it mostly commercial software companies that are answering them, or is it other architecture firms?
No, these are so far, it's, well, RFPs, so to people who are just doing coding for us. So like Rick Schlissner has been working on a kind of Revit panel piece, and he's been getting some former Autodesk people who are now freelancing to write the code to do that. Basically, that's an example of it starting out as a patch to Revit that would make Revit a little bit more efficient. You know, our large firm roundtable has been talking to Autodesk for years, and we'll go and have a high-level meeting with them, and we'll say, you know, here are the things we'd like. And they'll say, oh, those are great suggestions, but, you know, we've already set up our R&D for the next 3 years. So in about 4 years, we can have that on the list and we can get to it. And from our perspective, you know, 4 years from now, we're going to have a completely different list. So Greg set out to just do the little things that we wanted that they don't have time to do for us. What we realized was that related to data sharing and other things, setting up some of these standardizations within Revit is a crucial piece. And what we're finding is a lot of our initiatives all sort of link together in this way. It's basically what we're trying to get to is something that we build upon little brick by brick to set up an ecosystem that allows us to set up this digital transformation.
All right, well, you've set me up for a question that I was maybe going to be too polite to ask, but now I have to ask point blank, which is Autodesk, Peter. What to do about Autodesk? I mean, the switching costs of Autodesk are so high that firms are effectively locked into it. I mean, I don't know if you want to say this out loud, but I hope you will, that the IDC's ultimate project is to perhaps build some sort of alternative or map some path forward out of this? Because there's a lot of discussion out there, and Dan probably knows better than I, about what comes after Autodesk or what becomes the new front end at Autodesk. And I've had conversations about whether that's generative AI. Like, does that become the piece that becomes the new front end of this? Where does that product roadmap ultimately go to away from this lock-in effect of this massive vendor that everyone ultimately encounters? It reminds me of the line of the Matrix, right? They guard all the doors, they hold all the keys, like the only way out is to get around Autodesk somehow.
Yeah, I think certainly sitting around the bar after a large firm roundtable meeting, the CEOs have often talked about this particular issue. We had a meeting in Silicon Valley that conversation particularly bubbled up, and we had some, you know, explorations of to exactly what you said. Is there a way for us to pool our money? And I guess the answer is no. We don't think we can be a software company, and we're not going to try and upset Autodesk. I think we just have to figure out how to get use out of it that works for all of us. There may be someone else that comes out and does it, but it's not going to be the IDC. And it's a, you know, you're right. It's a huge monopoly. And I think the bad news for the architects is that we're such a small user compared to the gaming industry and construction that we're just not high on their priority list for the things that we want.
And that's crazy to think about because the origins, unfortunate of course, truth. Autodesk are in drafting and in architecture, but now their big, big ticket customers are not architecture firms. That's not only is it a monopoly, but it's a monopoly in which architecture firms are no longer the priority. That's crazy to think about.
Well, it is. And I think that's the, you know, those kind of conversations are what keep the CEOs up at night, because I think we're just afraid that all of our firms may eventually be pushed out of relevancy. And I think those fears are a large part of why we've all banded together to form the IDC, because we would like to have a continued place at the table in the design of buildings in the United States and the world. And we're worried that, as Bob Packard asked us, is there something out there that's going to do to us what Uber did to the taxi drivers? And I think that's a very real proposition.
Maybe perhaps a different or more optimistic take on this, you know, the pipeline of, you know, architecture student through to working all the way up to principal level is a really long and convoluted one. And through that pipeline are many, many jobs doing repetitive things like doorknob details. And there was always a big pool of labor that was coming out of undergraduate architecture particularly, where repetitive tasks were being done by young people who were, let's face it, easily exploited because it was their first job out of school and they didn't have a lot of design experience to bring to the table. Do you think that there is on the horizon, or has it already started to happen, an equalizing effect where the entry point for students who are coming out of school is actually now higher than it would have been, you know, a generation ago when everybody was kind of a CAD monkey, you know, to start with? Or is there just something just replaced it? Is there a new CAD monkey? It's been long enough that I've been out of practice that I haven't seen this pipeline up close. So I guess I'm just curious about where the software to exploitable intern interface lies right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. And things have changed. I mean, nobody sits around and details exit stairs at our firm anymore. We have about a half a dozen different standards for exit stairs, from like the most utilitarian that you'd have in an industrial building to something that you might have in a Class A office building, which is a higher level of finish and detail. And you know, those things are, those are now full automations within Revit that, you know, we'll figure out the code issues, and as the building design changes, they'll morph and so forth. So that's something that used to take, you know, endless amounts of hours for, and someone would learn doing those, the codes about exiting and fire codes and other things. I think now, and it used to be that when you came out of architecture school, they would tell you, oh, well, you're going to go to a firm and they'll teach you how to make construction documents and building codes and stuff. So we're just going to teach you how to think, right? So ironically now, that wasn't being taught in school, and it maybe not will not be taught in practice anymore, because those things are all getting automated. So to your point, you know, it's possible that people are jumping in a new level. But, you know, I would also say that being a successful architect is a lot more than just design. It's about understanding all these complex relationships within the industry and within your client, and how to communicate with a large group of people to get them all moving in the same direction to come up with the solution that is best. And that's still a very complex proposition, and something that I think takes years of experience for an architect to really be successful and have some impact. So I think those are the things that students coming out of college are going to have to learn. And some of the challenges that we're seeing to that now, I mean, our offices are working very remotely, is, are the young people getting connected to those conversations and experiences in the same way that they used to? Even if they weren't directly working on the project, they'd hear the principal on the phone sitting next to them having those conversations. And it was a lot of learning through osmosis that doesn't seem to be happening as readily these days.
In an ideal future, let's say, or a near-term ideal future, what is IDC working toward, and how would it materially affect the practice, especially the things that people like to complain about the most, which is something to do with the disconnect between education and implementation once you get to a firm? It's a very different experience. How do you think it might address some of the broader issues beyond the specifics of the technology and the tools, but also the structural issues?
And to build on that, one of the things that came out of the report that we did for the IDC at Cornell Tech was this idea that the generative stuff is flashy, but the deeper project is to basically do that, what they call in the consulting trades, digital transformation, and build that integrated pipeline as it flows through the firm. What does that pipeline look like to you, Peter? Is that partly what the IDC is trying to build towards, this model of what a common firm looks like in terms of how projects pass through its digital tools?
That's a great question. I don't think any of us, when I say any of us, I'm meaning the CEOs of the large firms, have an answer yet, other than I think we know we need to struggle with this question. And what we're talking about is, and what I alluded to earlier, is that kind of data transformation of an industry, and our businesses really requires everybody being involved. So right now, the impediments to it are somewhat, there's a political component. The legislatures and so forth have to rethink how they approve building plans, check building plans, because right now, most jurisdictions are still handing in a set of 2D documents somewhere. The attorneys, both on our side and for the clients, need to rethink how they write contractual agreements. I really think what we're going to see is, you know, there's continued blending of design and construction and fabrication. That's a whole nother realm of contractual issues that I think are going to have to adjust. And what I really think the future role of architects and engineers is going to be about bringing to the world the ability to see some kind of improved future environment, right? And leveraging this technology, working with a network of people. So in other words, it's not just architects and engineers on their own. It is with contractors and fabricators. We're so stuck in a rut right now of doing buildings the way we've done them for centuries, that loop has to break somewhere and be reconnected in a new way. And that's what we're talking about. Even our value proposition, we have to start thinking about, you know, what is the value of a new building to a client over time, and how do we get compensated for giving them something of special value for their business or their institution, and maybe be paid over time for that value, as opposed to selling them a set of 2D plans based on the hours that it took to create them, right? And so it's like what we're talking about is such a huge transformation that I don't think any one person yet can see into the future as to how that's going to happen. I think we're all kind of walking through the fog in the same direction right now, but we're really not sure where we're headed.
Well, that's a perfect place to leave a heck of a sales pitch there. Join the fog for our listeners yes. at the IDC. But a slightly more serious note, Peter. Yeah. So as a final question here, what is the IDC's roadmap over the next year? Why should firms, please make your sales pitch. Why should firms join the IDC to figure this out together? And what do you hope to accomplish in the next few months? And where will they see you again? You were just taking the wraps off of the IDC at the AEC Innovate Conference in Boston last month. Are there more events planned, or, you know, how should people get in touch with you and the firm?
Yeah. So we do follow up on inquiries that come through our website, which is just innovationdesignconsortium.com. And, you know, I would say that at least 40 CEOs of large firms all are in agreement that change is coming. And somehow or other, we are determined to remain relevant and be a part of that change in a positive way, rather than letting change happen to us. And we're developing all sorts of interesting tools. And you know, what I was, we sort of talked about this earlier when we asked, who do we hire? We're also hiring HR firms, right? One of the little tools that we're working on, we're mostly multi-office firms. So we have people in cities around the country. And we've realized since the pandemic that you can staff a project with people anywhere in the United States or around the globe, but you may not know those people and you may not know what their skill sets are. So we're helping firms put together a searchable skill set database, which, what does that do? Well, all the HR folks are interested because it's a way to develop skills within your firm, identify what skills you need to recruit or build. It's a way of helping people work through career paths so it was started out as something for operations. How do we staff projects? And now HR says, hey, this is a great tool for our annual performance reviews. And now we're all speaking a common language about the skill sets that we need to deliver projects. So this whole experience with the IDC is like you tug on a little thread and everything starts to unravel. And it's an exciting thing. And I would just say to people, if you're interested, give that thread a little tug and it'll keep on unraveling for you and you'll be caught up.
Excellent. Thank you for taking on this journey, Peter Devereaux, one of the co-founders of the Innovation Design Consortium and founding principal, HED. Thank you so much for being on Unfrozen today.
Thank you. Enjoy talking with you both.